We'll do it live! Fuck it!
Good evening and welcome to the Cosmic Highway Patrol. Coming at you from the outskirts of Brevard County, Florida, USA, I am your host, Matt Chouinard. Thank you for joining me. So what do you think of when you hear horror movie? Blood and guts, devil possession and serial killers? Maybe man-eating monsters on a killing spree? Perhaps the classics, like Frankenstein, Dracula, and Wolfman. Whatever you may think of, there's a subgenre or even an era that you'll probably like. From comedy to supernatural, torture porn to sci-fi. As far as torture porn goes, if you've seen movies like Saw or Hostel, you've watched it. Definitely not my favorite subgenre, but there's an ass for every seat, I suppose, so long as that seat doesn't have straps and a cattle prod nearby. So the horror movie genre has been around for a little over 100 years. Full disclosure, I'm going to be breezing through the 1920s to the early 60s pretty quickly. There were a lot of cinematic breakthroughs, but I'm a child of the 80s and 90s. The movies just weren't that interesting to me. Don't get me wrong, I love some of the old black and white movies. I've seen damn near every episode of Rod Serling's Twilight Zone. The stories in the beginning of Thalassophobia, Deepfakes, and 27 Club were meant to be a hyperbolic version of Rod Serling's opening monologues. And on top of all that, I'm wearing my Vincent Price shirt right now as we speak. I guess the point is, the things that were happening in the movie industry and the world during this time did more to shape the horror genre than the movies themselves. I could very well be wrong, but going through every era, it seems that graphic nature and overall effect on the audience in this time period was dictated immensely by what the filmmakers and society would allow. A horror movie is defined as a film genre that aims to evoke fear, dread, and suspense in the viewing audience. Typical elements are the supernatural, paranormal, man-eating monsters, psycho killers, and other situations that create a sense of anxiety and terror. The first silent film to do just that was the 1922 German film Nosferatu. Though it was a not-so-thinly-veiled ripoff of Bram Stoker's Dracula, it did have its differences. One of them being the movie is the first to show a vampire being killed by sunlight. Another being the overall appearance of this ghoul. I'll post a pic of this guy Count Orlok on the Instagram. What an absolute goblin of a man. Long, pointy fingers and ears, and really weird eyes. Anyway, this movie bore such a resemblance to Bram Stoker's Dracula that Bram's widow, Florence, sued the production company and the court ordered all copies to be destroyed. But not all copies were destroyed, and now Nosferatu is considered one of the classics amongst German expressionist cinema. Expressionism, by the way, is an artist using over-the-top performances and distortion to portray conflict and tension. Moving right along, we find ourselves in the early 1930s where we see the first depictions of Dracula, Frankenstein's monster, and Wolfman, making Bela Lugosi, Boris Karloff, and Lon Chaney Jr. mainstays in the horror genre. This is the pre-code era. The term pre-code horror movie means any horror film made before 1934. Often featuring more graphic and unsettling content, including violence, sexuality, and the supernatural, than what was allowed once the Hays Code went into effect in 1934. The Hays Code led to stricter and more sanitized character portrayal and storylines. These square-ass, high-pants-wearing, no-fun-having fuddy-duddies took all the appeal out of movies in general, horror movies in particular, until the early 70s. Stay with me, I'm going somewhere with this. 1931's Dracula, starring Bela Lugosi, gave the Count the thick Hungarian accent that we've all come to know and love.
Oh, greetings, it is I, the Count!
As well as the slick back hair and the cape, which set the look for just about every Dracula depiction for decades to come. This movie follows the same storyline as Bram Stoker's Dracula with the arrival of the Count in England, along with the characters. It was this movie that defined vampire tropes we know today, establishing fear of garlic, crosses, and the need for a wooden cross to kill a vampire into vampire lore. Dracula was a success at the box office, putting the horror genre on the map. soon after Frankenstein and the Mummy were released. Just 2 days after Pearl Harbor, the Wolfman was released, and presumably the Halloween costume industry sprung up and circled its wagons around these characters for decades. By the late 40s, monster movies lost their shine, leading to production companies re-releasing old movies after the war. In 1948, the first horror comedy movie was made with Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. It was about this time that low-budget independent horror movies called B-movies became popular. A lot of these movies featured monsters and mad scientists, slowly ushering in the sci-fi horror subgenre. Movies like Invasions of the Body Snatchers and War of the Worlds heavily feature alien invasion and the fear of the unknown. It really shouldn't come as a surprise considering the Roswell crash in 1947 and the subsequent UFO sightings of the time. Movies from this time period do a pretty good job of reflecting society's fascination with the unknown and all things sci-fi. It's also worth mentioning that the fears of the Cold War and threats of invaders being something of a subplot to a lot of these movies. So as I said earlier, I love the original Twilight Zone. The first Twilight Zone episode titled Where Is Everybody first aired on October 2nd, 1959, beginning a 5-season run that explored science fiction, horror, and suspense. I really liked it because every story had a point. And I know, The Outer Limits was a show too, but Twilight Zone was better. Come at me. At Cosmic Highway Patrol on Instagram and cosmichighwaypatrol@gmail.com, you tell me what you think. To this day, I still randomly scroll through Twilight Zone episodes and just pick one. It was about this time, June 16th, 1960 to be exact, that horror landmark Psycho was released. A Hitchcock masterpiece. This particular movie was groundbreaking as far as its portrayal of violence on the big screen. Alfred Hitchcock had his own marketing strategy when the film was released. In order to keep potential audiences in the dark, Hitchcock insisted that theaters not allow anyone late to the show to enter, as well as asking film critics not to spoil the plot twists and details. This led to audiences buying a ticket without knowing what the movie is about. This marketing strategy led to changes in how movies were marketed and watched. As far as the violence, this movie changed the way violence was depicted. The famous shower scene only lasted for about 45 seconds, but the stab wounds weren't shown and there was very little blood, leaving the horrific scene to the audience's imagination. Due to the black and white format, chocolate syrup was used to portray blood. This was done because it showed up better than fake blood would have, and it provided just enough gore to be both chilling and convincing. The star of this scene, Janet Leigh, is the mother of Scream Queen Jamie Lee Curtis, star of the Halloween franchise, among many other movies. I think she's also a spokeswoman for some yogurt company or probiotic or, I don't know, something like that. Anyway, we will be getting to that era shortly. Later on in the decade, groundbreaking zombie flick Night of the Living Dead was released, directed by George Romero on an incredibly limited budget. This was the first movie to portray zombies as we know them today as flesh-eating, ravenous undead as opposed to being controlled by a master of some kind. This movie was something else. Due to the incredibly low budget, the filmmakers had to have some imagination when it came to props and special effects. Much like Psycho, Night of the Living Dead was black and white, and also like Psycho, chocolate syrup was used in place of fake blood. However, we're not talking about an incel with an unhealthy attachment to his mother. We're talking zombies. In several scenes, pig's feet were used to imitate human bones and limbs, as well as animal guts to mimic, well, guts. It also featured a diverse cast, including African-American actor named Dwayne Jones as the lead role, which was quite unusual for the time. This movie in particular led to numerous sequels, spin-offs, imitations, and remakes. It goes without saying that if there wasn't this movie, we wouldn't have The Walking Dead or the countless spin-offs and zombie cash grabs in the 2010s. So as the Vietnam War was winding down and the Watergate scandal was heating up, 1973's The Exorcist was unleashed upon humanity.
Stick your cock up her ass, you motherfucking worthless cocksucker.
Tim, Jesus, fuck you! Tim, Jesus, fuck you! Lick me! Lick me!
Your mother sucks cocks in hell.
And let's not forget Texas Chainsaw Massacre, released just 1 year later. That's right, everybody. We have entered the new Hollywood era, the 1970s, the decade where serial killers reigned supreme and widespread lead poisoning was a way of life. Blood, guts, knives, sex, and chainsaws! Whew! Anyway, the new Hollywood era lasted from the late 60s to the early 80s. If you're a fellow Gen Xer, then you will probably recognize most of the movies of this era as movies your mom wouldn't let you rent from Blockbuster, but you watched at a friend's house on sleepovers anyway. It's worth mentioning that the rise of popularity and viewership of these movies from this era rose due to the accessibility of VHS and movie rentals. I think just about everyone over the age of 30 remembers going to the video store and walking up and down the aisles looking at the movie covers. You could tell which ones were comedies, dramas, sci-fi, and horror. There was also that section behind the beaded curtain. The Exorcist is widely regarded as one of the scariest movies ever made. I mean, it should come as no surprise that a real-life serial killer was a part of the cast, but I'll get into that in a bit. Released on December 26, 1973, it went on to be the 9th highest grossing movie of all time and the highest grossing R-rated movie ever. Anybody who has ever seen this movie knows that even for its time, it was groundbreaking. And barrier-breaking from a racial standpoint when it came to distribution. When first released, the movie was only shown in theaters in predominantly white areas. Turns out, in spite of the fact that there are no black characters in the movie, the mystique of devil possession could be appreciated by everyone. Weird. Apparently the execs never heard of voodoo. Moving right along, during the initial screenings, this movie had some audience members fainting, vomiting, and feeling incredible fear. I guess they were onto something. It was considered blasphemous. So much so, it was banned in several countries. Go ahead, take all the time you need. Try and guess what countries and why. So keep in mind that live death had been broadcast nightly for years throughout the Vietnam War, and the Zapruder film showing JFK's head being blown off while in a motorcade wasn't shown to the public until 1969 in LA and 1970 in Chicago. The public, by and large, had never seen real-world up-close violence on TV or at the theater. I contend that The Exorcist is more shocking than anything filmed before it. The times were changing in the movie industry. Roger Ebert said, quote, "I'm not sure exactly what reasons people will have for seeing this movie. Surely enjoyment won't be one. Are people so numb they need movies of this intensity in order to feel anything at all?" Yep. According to the raw data, apparently a wide swath of the public needs this kind of entertainment. Much like the flagellants being the hottest show going during the plagues in the Middle Ages. I could go down a rabbit hole on dark entertainment during dark times, but I digress. Have you ever seen the show Mindhunter? Well, season 2, episode 6 features an interview with a guy named Paul Bateson. If you want to know more about this guy, look him up. In the late 70s, he was convicted of murder of a film critic. Oh, real quick, he was the guy with the Caesar haircut and the beard giving Reagan the cerebral angiography in the scene most viewers found to be the most disturbing. I'm pretty sure that was real blood shooting around, too. So now that we've established dark times call for dark entertainment, the 1970s were a time of turmoil, upheaval, crime was off the charts, and the golden age of the American serial killer was well underway. Bundy, Berkowitz, Buono, Bianchi, Kemper, Gacy, and Coral were doing their thing, creating chaos wherever they were. When I think of the 70s, I think of good music, cheap muscle cars, and denim bell-bottoms. But I wasn't there. Apparently, it sucked and was awesome all at the same time. Serial killers were in the public psyche by the late 70s, especially when Bundy, Gacy, and the Hillside Stranglers were caught all around the same time. Enter the slasher flick age with Halloween, released on October 25th, 1978. I love this movie. Leading role, Laurie Strode, played by Jamie Lee Curtis, daughter of portrayed victim in Psycho, is the modern-day Scream Queen. The film's antagonist, Michael Myers, is seen throughout the film wearing a William Shatner mask that was painted white. This particular mask was chosen for its blank and emotionless expression, which just added to the unsettling appearance of the character. Like many movies of this time and subgenre, it was done on an incredibly low budget and short filming schedule, taking just 20 days from pre-production to filming. One thing that sets Halloween apart is the relative lack of violence and gore, rather focusing on suspense and psychological horror. In spite of the low budget and short filming schedule, Halloween was a massive success at the box office, making back over 200 times the budget, making it one of the most successful indie films of all time. And with that success came a boom of slasher flicks coming out from the late 70s to the late 80s. 2 years later, on May 9, 1980, the first of many Friday the 13th movies came out. Friday the 13th was yet another low-budget success, turning $550,000 budget into $39 million profit in the U.S. As iconic as Jason Voorhees has become over the years, I don't think I need to go and throw out any spoiler alert when I say he wasn't the killer in the first one. The iconic hockey mask? Not seen until part 3. This movie has some pretty good kill scenes thanks to legendary horror makeup guru Tom Savini. Savini was a combat photographer in Vietnam, giving him firsthand knowledge of what guts and gore actually look like, making him the special effects go-to in the 70s and 80s. 4 years after the first Friday the 13th was released, Wes Craven's A Nightmare on Elm Street hit the theaters, completing the holy trinity of horror with the child-killing horror mainstay Freddy Krueger. Nightmare on Elm Street would go on to spawn 7 sequels, a reboot, and a crossover with Jason in 2003. This was bested by Friday the 13th with 10 sequels and a reboot, and Halloween with 11 sequels, a reboot, and a reboot sequel. It's weird. It's kind of like Hollywood has been fresh out of ideas since the 80s. These three movie franchises have 33 movies between them. As the 1980s rolled on, the serial killer trope continued with Child's Play featuring Chucky the homicidal doll, possessed by fictional serial killer Charles Lee Ray. This movie also went on to release 6 sequels and a reboot.
It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again.
As the 80s became the 90s, the horror genre moved away from the blood and guts of the 70s and 80s and went for more of a psychological and supernatural approach with Jacob's Ladder, Silence of the Lambs, The Sixth Sense, and The Blair Witch Project. And no, Silence of the Lambs isn't classified as a horror movie, but the elements are there. One movie that stands out as a quintessential 90s horror flick is 1996's Scream. I mean, yeah, it could probably be considered another slasher flick, but the way it was done is what makes it interesting. Directed by Nightmare on Elm Street's own Wes Craven, this particular movie defied conventions and cliches of the genre, flipping things around, and kept things interesting without becoming a complete parody of itself. It basically made the movie industry have to start thinking a little more creatively about a particularly well-worn genre. And in that creativity came 1999's Blair Witch Project.
Help! Please help us! Help us!
This is not the way to get out of here.
Anybody who was around in the late 90s has at least heard of this movie. I saw it at the theater a couple months after I graduated. I gotta admit, I was underwhelmed and left the theater with a slight headache from all the camera movement. But this movie changed the game in ways that we see to this day. The sneaky rat bastards that put this marketing campaign together deserve either a medal or to be thrown in jail for a couple of weeks. Truth be told, it was pretty clever. So here's how it all worked. Leading up to the film's release, Blair Witch writers Daniel Myrick and Eduardo Sanchez made a mockumentary called Curse of the Blair Witch, which was broadcast on Sci-Fi Channel. This, quote, documentary went through the Blair Witch mythos and worked in that there were 3 missing student filmmakers that haven't been seen since 1994. And of course, being the late 90s, the movie had a website containing fake police reports, interviews, and a bona fide missing persons poster, both on the website and distributed paper copies. This marketing scheme publicly tap-danced on the line between fiction and reality. The outcome was people buying a ticket to the Blair Witch Project thinking they were seeing real-life proof of the paranormal, footage found years later depicting these students' last days. As the viewing public, we got trust issues and a new subgenre, found footage. Much like the reality TV that got popular soon after the release, movie producers found that low-budget found footage movies cost pennies to make, relatively, and returns are usually somewhat substantial. Blair Witch was made on a budget of $60,000 to $250,000, depending on where you look. Either way, it turned the cost of a run-down studio apartment into a $248 million payday worldwide. Without the popularity of Blair Witch, we wouldn't have Cloverfield with four sequels, Paranormal Activity and its seven sequels, or VHS with its five sequels. Though not nearly as prolific as the Holy Trinity of Horror I mentioned earlier, give them time. Sequels, prequels, and reboots seem to be the law of the land throughout the 2000s and 2010s. Right before I started recording tonight, I watched the critically acclaimed 2017 horror flick, Get Out. Okay, so, it only took about 5 minutes to realize this movie was going to contain more social commentary than horror. Like, a lot more. By minute 45, it's like, I get it. Rich white people are manipulative, racist, and lack manners. I'm not feeling particularly astonished right now. It wasn't until an hour and 15 minutes that things got interesting. Social commentary and underlying themes are pretty much the latest trend. Take 2018's Hereditary, for instance. I had a hard time following what it was about right on into the end credits. Or the 2017 Jennifer Lawrence Javier Bardem vehicle, Mother. I have an easier time believing a tulpa with finger knives can show up in the dreams of sleeping teenagers than anything that happened in the last half of that movie. Modern horror just isn't for me. It seems that screenwriters are muddling the story with underlying themes and the critics love them for it. So that is a brief history on the horror movie. I was going to talk about the bitchin' rides of horror, like the 58 Plymouth Fury starring in the 1983 Stephen King movie Christine, co-starring a super clean 68 Charger and a once nice 67 Z28, or the Phantasm Cuda. But that's not what this is about. And I know there are so many movies I didn't mention, or anthologies like Tales from the Crypt or Creepshow. I haven't forgotten Hellraiser, Evil Dead, House of a Thousand Corpses. Time just wouldn't allow it. I'm sorry.
This is my boomstick!
I'm thinking I might start up a little mini-sode thing every other week in between the episodes. You know, some place where I can cover the things that I missed or omitted from the main episodes, and I can rant and carry on about whatever. I don't know. Maybe. Either way, what'd you think? Let me know at CosmicHighwayPatrol@gmail.com or CosmicHighwayPatrol on Instagram. I'm looking for episode suggestions, so if you have one, drop me a line. I think that about does it for me. Let's go out on some Dutch magic, shall we? Good night, take care.
Now, when I was a young boy, I wanted to watch them all the time.